The Jodcast. Wondering if there's any Belgian monks on those Trappist planets. With Hayden Rampadarath, Jean-Francois Robitaille, Monique Henson, Mike Garrett, and Matthias Valente. The Jodcast, March 2017 Extra Edition. Hello, and welcome to The Jodcast. I'm Monique, and joining me in the studio are Jeff, Hayden, and Mike. Welcome to The Jodcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I believe it's all your first times presenting, although we're going to hear some interviews from you, Jeff and Hayden, later on. And Mike, I believe you've been interviewed before. Jeff and Hayden, you've not been on The Jodcast before. Could you introduce yourselves, tell us a little bit about what you do?
So I'm Hayden Rampadarath. I'm a postdoc here at University of Manchester. I mostly work on the SK Imaging Development Pipeline team. I also kind of sometimes on the side work on, I'm interested in low luminosity AGNs, which are very tiny black holes, very weak black holes that exist in in large galaxies.
I'm Jean-François Robitaille, or Jeff is fine as well. So I believe I've been interviewed once in the past. I don't remember when exactly. I'm also a postdoc here in Manchester, and I'm studying the turbulence in the interstellar medium and as well the magnetic field.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's good to have you here.
So in the shortest time, Matt answers your astronomical questions. And we have two very special interviews we did in a recent conference, a SETI conference that is, that took place at Georgia Bank Center for Astrophysics. And before we get to that, could I ask Mike about the conference, since you were the host of this conference, could you tell us a little bit about it?
Okay, so every year there's a meeting of the UK SETI Research Network. That's a group of mostly academics who are interested in SETI, which is the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Mostly astronomers, but actually also from various other disciplines. We all get together and share some of our work, give presentations, and talk about how we can move the whole sort of SETI research forward in the UK. So this year we volunteered here in Manchester to host the meeting. And I think it was a very interesting meeting. We enjoyed it very much.
I may have a question for you. So it was the first time I've been to a SETI conference like this. And so the range of subject was really broad. Is it always like that?
Well, it depends what kind of SETI meeting you go to, but certainly the research network here in the UK, the idea is really to be try and be as inclusive as possible. So not just astronomers or physicists, but really try and reach out to people who are interested in sort of artistic aspects of SETI, also, you know, novel science fiction, also people that are interested in anthropology, zoology. There's a lot of things that, you know, when you start thinking about extraterrestrial life, that, you know, has relevance to some of these topics. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And for you, like, why do you feel SETI is worth pursuing? Because I know in the astronomy community there's quite a few skeptics, but then, you know, there's also a lot of people doing research. So what justifies it for you?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I think the astronomical community is kind of split down the middle. You know, half the people think that it's pretty interesting, and the other half are, as you say, a bit sceptical and maybe think we're wasting time. And then there's that 5% that are really, really gung-ho in it and really think it's the most important thing ever, which is probably me. Mm-hmm. And I think that just because as astronomers, you know, we can address all sorts of fundamental questions. For example, you know, how did the universe start? You know, how did the planets form, stars form, etc.? How did galaxies evolve through cosmic time? And these are all important questions, and they're interesting to astronomers, but I think they're also of interest to a lot of people, you know, normal people out there. And the other big question, which I think is relevant, is, you know, are we alone in the universe, or are there other planets with intelligent life on them? That also seems to me to be a really kind of major question that you would like to know the answer to. And I also think that astronomers can learn a bit from thinking more broadly. So that 50% of astronomers that are a little bit sceptic, you notice that they they really only think about, you know, what's above the Earth or what's outside the Earth or even what's outside the solar system, and they concern themselves with that. But I think if we also realise that life on this planet seems to be rather special or really important, and how you can combine that with a bigger picture of the universe that's not just about the Big Bang or the formation of the first stars or the evolution of galaxies, but the whole picture. And to me, the whole picture is also about life forming on planets, and in particular, intelligent life forming on planets and how that evolves.
No, I think that's a really good point. I'll admit that I sometimes fall into the camp of one of those skeptics. And particularly, I'm a cosmologist, so I look at the universe on really big scales, and I have been known to say I don't care about anything smaller than a galaxy. So I think it's good to be reminded of the bigger picture, which includes the smaller picture.
Yeah, so let's get on to our first interview, in which we talked to Danny Price and Jamie Drew about the Breakthrough Initiative.
Good day. My name is Hayden Rampadarath. I'm a postdoc here at Jodrell Bank Center for Astrophysics. And
I'm Jean-François Robitaille. I'm also a postdoc at the University of Manchester.
And for the last 2 days, we've been having part of the UK SETI Research Network. There's been lots of talks about SETI and very important discussions about the future and even current events. I also have two members, one from Breakthrough Initiative, which is Jamie Drew, and Danny Price from Breakthrough Listen. So first of all, I'll pass it over to Jamie Drew, and he'll introduce himself and talk a little bit about Breakthrough Initiatives.
Certainly. So my name is Jamie Drew. I'm the Chief of Staff with the Breakthrough Prize Foundation and a Project Manager with the Breakthrough Initiatives. I may start by saying that the Breakthrough Initiatives were announced in July 20th at the Royal Society in 2015 with Stephen Hawking and Sir Martin Rees, as well as our chairman, Dr. S. Pete Warden, and our primary sponsor, Mr. Yuri Milner. And the Breakthrough Initiatives, is kind of in one sentence, is really a philanthropic private program looking at searching for life in the universe and in all of its forms, and space exploration. We have announced a series of initiatives, but we're primarily here at the UK SETI Research Network Symposium to talk about SETI and our first initiative called Breakthrough Listen, which is a $100 million investment in the field of SETI. And we decided to contract UC Berkeley in sunny California to run that program. Of course, have Danny Price here from that program today. So,
Before we move over to Danny, in your talk you had mentioned about bringing SETI into the academic arena. Could you briefly talk about that? Like what do you really mean in that sense?
So SETI has been around for quite some time now, and in kind of an analysis of efforts of the past, there's a rich history of prominent figures and individuals and papers. SETI has not necessarily matured in the field of academic thought or academic institutions as a proper discipline. And so one of the primary objectives of the Breakthrough Initiatives is to make Breakthrough Listen the vehicle at which we provide the financial resources, the intellectual resources, and the people to make it a rigorous scientific discipline, bringing SETI into mainstream astronomy. That is our primary goal. And, you know, one measurement of that is peer-reviewed publications. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to involve ourselves internationally on the kind of publishing circuit, as well as at academic conferences, to really engage with the astronomy community on the field of SETI and finding its place in a more permanent way.
Right, yeah. That sounds very exciting, actually.
Yeah, maybe I have one question. So about, the philanthropy and the private sector. So we see it a lot those days with, for example, SpaceX, and you mentioned Bigelow as well, aerospace or something. Yeah. Do you think it's the future of fundamental research in general, or?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. Most people's conscious of the space age is the likes of Yuri Gagarin or the first Apollo landings or Sputnik. That's the space age. But the space age really began hundreds of years prior to that with ground-based observations, astronomers doing the kind of monotonous and at times lonely work of staring at the stars. So your kind of Galileo to Gagarin period was dominated, interestingly enough, by a large contribution of private actors. That is to say, wealthy industrialists who put money into the field of space exploration, ground-based space exploration. So in sunny California, where the Breakthrough Initiatives are headquartered, we have an observatory called Lick Observatory. And James Lick was a wealthy industrialist at the time, 1800s, who decided that he would contribute nearly a fourth or third of his wealth. At first, he wanted to build a pyramid in downtown San Francisco, and he was convinced that perhaps he should put his money towards scientific pursuits. So he put it in the Lick Observatory. You know, I think it was equivalent to about, in today's U.S. dollars, about $1.2 billion of his net worth. And what you find during that period is the majority of observatories in the United States were built through private means and private mechanisms. Early rocketry as well with Goddard. So today, as you mentioned, SpaceX, Bigelow and Jeff Bezos and other dynamic and wealthy individuals involved in what has been characterized as the new space age. This commercial attribute is not necessarily anything new. There's a wonderful book being published, I believe, this year or next year by Alex MacDonald that describes this as a reemergence of private investment in space. And the Breakthrough Initiatives are much in the same vein, a private institution following a long history of private investment in space exploration. Perhaps what makes us a bit unique is probably the first most kind of significant contribution to the field of SETI. Of course, there's been Paul Allen in the back with the Allen Telescope Array and the SETI Institute. But with the announcement of Breakthrough Starshot, which is looking at accelerating a small miniaturized probe to our nearest sun, 4.3 light years away, the Alpha Centauri system, looking at accelerating at a velocity of 20% light speed, would probably be the first philanthropic nonprofit organization that has a space mission, a space-based mission. So that's kind of exciting. But again, we come from a long history of long economic history of private investments in space exploration. So yeah.
Thanks a lot, Jamie. So now we'll switch over to Danny Price, and we'll probably ask him to describe a little bit more of Breakthrough Listen, because it's the current actual work being done by Breakthrough Initiative. So Danny.
Sure. Okay. Well, so Breakthrough Listen is a 10-year, $100 million program to try and answer the question, are we alone in the universe? So it is a SETI program, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and we are using the best telescopes we can to make the most sensitive and widest bandwidth measurements that are possible. So the kind of first few telescopes we've been using have been the Parkes 64-meter telescope in New South Wales in Australia, the 100-meter aperture Greenbank telescope in West Virginia, which is one of the largest steerable structures in the world. The Chernobyl sarcophagus is now the largest movable structure in the world. And we're also using the APF telescope at Lick Observatory, which, as Jamie mentioned, Lick Observatory was originally funded via philanthropic means. So they're the three main telescopes we're using. The Breakthrough Foundation has agreements that we get a certain percentage of the time to do our SETI observations. The other aspect of it is that we've built new digital systems so that we can expand the capabilities of these telescopes in a way that hasn't been done before. So, for example, at Greenbank, we now have about half of our system installed, but when the full system is installed, we'll be able to record 10 gigahertz worth of bandwidth from the telescope instantly. And what that means is, in terms of searching the electromagnetic spectrum, the electromagnetic spectrum is very wide. It goes from 10 meter kind of wavelengths all the way up through to a couple of centimeters. There's a radio window there, and to cover that entire radio window traditionally required many different pointings with many different receivers. That takes a lot more time to do. What we want to do with Breakthrough Listen is to try and cover as much of the electromagnetic spectrum as possible with the fewest pointings of the telescope. And that just means it's a lot more efficient and you can cover a lot more ground. So if you imagine with FM radio, if you tune in, you move the dial slowly and you get to a particular frequency at which there's some information being broadcast. But if you can only view a little kind of narrow channel at once, if you're just going through with your headphones and you're twisting a dial, it'll be very slow and it would take a very long time to get through the entire spectrum. We're covering tens of gigahertz worth of bandwidth at once, and that means that we can be a lot more efficient, but it also means we need a lot more computing hardware there. So we've installed a new system at Greenbank, a new system at Parkes, and we're developing new systems for future telescopes as well.
So, well, as you say, future telescopes, one question, why these particular telescopes?
So there's a variety of different ways you can go about searching for signals that would suggest that there is life beyond Earth. So the main reason we want to use Parkes and Greenbank is because it fits our first observational strategy very well. So I think lots of interesting questions, but for me, one of the most interesting one is of the closest stars, how many of those have habitable planets and how many of those could possibly have an intelligent civilization on them? And if you're limiting yourself just to a close volume of stars, then you can do targeted observations where you take a telescope, point it at that star, take some data and see if you see anything. Mm-hmm. And with the large single dish telescopes that we're using, Greenbanks and Parkes, they have a very large aperture, meaning they collect a lot of light. But that also means that they have a very small field of view. So it makes them very good for targeted observations of stars. But if you wanted to do a survey, you might want to use a different instrument. So radio astronomy, radio interferometers, where you get lots of smaller dishes and combine their signals to make synthesized images. That approach we'd also want to use for a different survey strategy. And so the Breakthrough Listen program has three main goals. The first is to survey 1 million nearby stars, and then we want to do a survey of the galactic plane, and then we want to do a survey of the 100 nearest galaxies. And so with that, we get a large sampling of parameter space.
So one question, what type of signal do you look for? So how could you tell that signal would be from a civilization versus from, let's say, a mesa, for instance, which is also narrowband?
That's a very good question. And the answer is, of course, we don't know exactly what signal to expect. But the kind of class of signals we're looking for are things that are notably artificial in some way. So an example of that would be something that was very narrow in frequency, which if it was narrower than that you expect from spectral things and things like masers, and which have they're still very narrow bandwidth, but they're narrow on kind of kilohertz scales, whereas we look down to the hertz level.
So Doppler shifting bandwidth of your signals is also one of those signals.
That is
well.
One. So in terms of telling if a signal is artificial or not, you can look at very narrow band or like very high time resolution signals. In terms of telling if it's terrestrial or extraterrestrial, the main way you can do that is by using things like Doppler shift. So if a signal is based on Earth and you don't expect to see things like Doppler shift, because as the Earth rotates, the transmitter is also rotating at the same speed. Whereas if you have a transmitter in space as the Earth rotates, you do expect to see Doppler shifts. If you have a signal that's traversed a very long distance and is broadband, then you expect to see dispersion on the signal, where the propagation through the intergalactic medium means that you get a different time of arrival for different frequencies. So there are things that you would expect a extraterrestrial signal to have just based on the literal physics of the signal transmission. But all we can really say is that we are looking for artificial signals and we're looking through as much of the parameter space as possible. And we're trying to do that in using some more modern methods as well. So one thing I think is worth mentioning is there's a lot of work coming out of machine learning and deep learning, And some of those classification algorithms may end up being very useful for sifting through the large amounts of data we have.
I might have a question along those lines. If I understood well during your talk, you said that breakthrough listen data will be public as well.
Mm-hmm.
So are you thinking about maybe an updated version of City at Home or something like that, or create a civilian project like Galaxy Zoo to analyze this kind of data?
Our approach is different to SETI at Home and different to Galaxy Zoo. So with SETI at Home, they have a set of algorithms and they get you to download the screensaver, install it on your computer, and then your computer will then, whenever your screensaver is running, download some data and process that and then send the results back. And that's good if you want to do a class of algorithms which are very computationally intensive but have low bandwidth in requirements, because you have to send the data all throughout the internet. Given the data volumes we have with Breakthrough Listen, that paradigm, it doesn't map so well onto the problem. For us, it's better to try and use data locality and have the compute done as close to the data as possible. So with the data archive, we're making it open to everybody, but we also hope that we can provide some compute facility. So you, similar to a supercomputer, you can log on and do some of the data analysis there.
Okay, maybe ask for some times on the computer.
With things like Galaxy Zoo, where you have some data and you're going through it, I think that is an interesting option to look through, but it requires a little bit more data processing to be done. So you need a little bit more richness in the data that has to be provided before the general public can just go and start clicking things. So I guess with the data archive, we want everyone who has any interest to just be able to download it. But we also want people who have specific skills, so from communications or from deep learning or astrophysicists who work on a different problem, we want to give them the ability to get the data and play around. And perhaps even not looking for signs of ET, but looking for new mitigation algorithms or exoplanets or anything like that.
Yes, of course.
I might just add that on this topic of analysis and software engineering, there's kind of a trend that, you know, much of the future of astronomy lies in software engineering or software, various types of algorithm development. And the wonderful and beautiful thing about being based in Berkeley or down in Mountain View, Moffett Field, in Silicon Valley, essentially, is that this is an epicenter for much of that type of work. And so one of our interests is not only to collaborate within the academic community internationally, but also with private industry when it comes to the development of sophisticated algorithms to tease out signals. Because the notion of collecting more data in order to analyze, you know, some may deem less important than understanding how to view the data that we perhaps have already collected. And so we aspire to run a program that really engages with the hearts and minds of software engineers in Silicon Valley. So
is this the software dogma? You say, in your talk, you mentioned that introducing software, Silicon Valley dogma into SETI and academics is one of the key initiatives as well. So that sounds really exciting. So one person in the meeting has, and this question is plaguing my mind slightly, is like, they said, and you answered it, somebody suggested to wait 50 years for technology to improve before we could do it. Breakthrough isn't doing that. So my question for both of you, either one of you, what do you think about that? I mean, so it's like, for the listeners, somebody suggested, like, since Drake did the first SETI experiment back in the 60s, astronomy and science has really moved forward, but SETI had stayed down. And it's only when technology start improving, then we start seeing more advancement in some of these sciences. So somebody suggested that maybe we just wait 50 years. And then when technology improves, we detect SETI instead of go through next 50 years. So I would like to hear your opinions on that.
I think it's a little bit of a false dichotomy. We can do stuff in 50 years and we can do stuff now. And doing things now has the advantages of we can get some answers now, and they may not be as good as they will in 50 years. But if you look at the progress of science, I mean, if we had done no science up to now and managed to get the technology to where it is now without going through all the hard work to make that technology, but if we just, you know, woke up one day and we had the better technology, then we could have done some of these extremely hard measurements that people spend their entire life working toward answering could be done very quickly. But that's not the way it works. And I think it's important on many levels to innovate and to try and answer things now. In terms of like the next kind of 15, 20 years, the foreseeable future of astronomy, now is the perfect time to be doing SETI, because we now know, thanks to Kepler and other missions, that there's a large amount of exoplanets out there, and that, you know, basically every star has a planetary system, and one in five stars has a planet that could be in the habitable zone. So we know that there's a good motivation to go out and start looking, and we do have very good technology now. So with the single dish telescopes, we are getting the maximum that we possibly can without the next large increase in capability of the actual analog systems of the telescopes. So while it may be true in 50 years things will be better, I think doing things now is important, and also keeping the community alive. If you don't do anything for 50 years and then suddenly expect to be able to ramp up, that's just not how it works. Also, if we want to get onto the next generation of telescopes, like the Square Kilometer Array, we need to be doing things now to make sure that it's designed in to the system, and that it's possible to create the data products that we would like.
Yes, I totally agree with you about these things.
I might just add that there's also, you know, in retrospect, it's kind of easy to review what has been done. It's quite difficult to predict the future, perhaps impossible. But what we do know is that somewhat of a constant is luck is a variable that plays into a lot of what happens at times in science, and that you never know. There's kind of a serendipity of space exploration. You don't know what you're going to stumble upon, and there's been a great deal of discoveries anticipating perhaps a discovery in one field but coming up with something else in some other field. Like fast radio bursts was perhaps one of those. So the time's right as well, because when one is presented with an opportunity of public interest due to the discovery of so many exoplanets and science broadening throughout the world, access to information and technologies, and the confluence of kind of monetary wealth in the private sphere, investing in fields that are deemed to be difficult to invest in with public funding because there's a very low chance of any substantial return on investment. Private money makes a lot of sense in those regards. You tend to invest in high risk projects. And this is a high risk program. And if there's a chance for return on investment, that's probably one of the most extraordinary returns on investment that humanity could ever possibly conceive of. So, and it's difficult to spend public money on programs like that. So that's, yeah, the time's right financially as well, in a way.
One last question would be, so what should we, the viewer, or the listeners and the public, look forward to breakthrough?
Okay, well, so the main method we'll be using to kind of put yardsticks out is to show our progress is peer-reviewed publications. Mm. We're working at the moment on our first few publications coming out, which will be detailing the digital systems and the data analysis approaches we're using. But in the future, we're going to keep this very scientifically rigorous peer-reviewed path. And whenever we release something that is of interest to the public, we'll make sure that we also release a press release to say. But the thing that's going to happen in the next 3 years in terms of the observing program is we will survey all of the... We have the sample of about 1,500 nearby stars that we're looking at with the Green Bank telescope. And in the next 3 years, we'll complete that over all the different receivers on the telescope, and we'll be able to answer the question, out of those 1,500 stars, is there anything unusual about them in the the bands that we're able to look at here from Earth. With Parkes, we're going to be doing a galactic plane survey, so using the receiver they have there that has a very fast survey speed to look at the galactic plane and see if there's anything unusual, any evidence of an artificial signal there. So I guess they're the two main data sets. After that and going through the next 7 years of the Breakthrough program, we'll be expanding from 1,000 to 1,000,000 stars and also adding galaxies into the mix. And
you were also thinking about adding the Lovell telescope as well.
Well, you know, we're hoping to get as large a fleet of telescopes as we possibly can that fit into our observing program. We need to be able to analyze the data as well, so we don't want to stretch ourselves too thin. But we're hoping to install some systems on the Lovell telescope and do some SETI here, get some SETI in the UK. We're here at the UK SETI Research Network. And so there are people who are doing SETI in the UK, but in terms of observational SETI where they're taking data, that's been a little thin on the ground just because there haven't been the opportunities to do so. We're also looking at using the Meerkat telescope in South Africa. We're very interested in that because that gives us a path toward the SKA, the Square Kilometre Array. And the Square Kilometre Array will be the premier radio telescope in the world at low to mid frequencies. And being able to do SETI on that would be very groundbreaking just because of its sensitivity.
One question I have to ask is, so how, as let's say someone listening to this want to get involved in some level? You said public data, so eventually that will be there. So is there any other way, let's say, to someone's very interested in getting moving forward in these things, if they want to get involved, how can they get involved?
Yeah, well, we're still in the first few stages of getting our public data archive up and running. But once we do, anyone can go and download the data, and we're trying to provide a toolkit to get some of the entry-level barriers. So, for example, you don't have to know too much about the file format. For the first few years, I expect that to really get involved, you'll have to have some acuity with computers. You may not need to know every single little bit about the telescope, but you will need to know how to write a simple script and how to plot data and things. So there will still be some technical hurdles for people, but at least in the short term. Longer term, we would like for as many people as possible to be able to access the data.
And probably education in schools eventually.
Yeah, so we have some people working on outreach. So, for example, we have a guy in Berkeley, Steve Croft, is very interested in making sure that we maximize the outreach potential. And so we're trying to provide little tools and utilities so that schools and community groups can play around with the data and kind of understand a little bit more about how everything works.
I think that's it. And yeah. Thank you, Jamie and Danny, for your time. I mean, it was very, very informative discussion. So
thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for that, Jeff and Hayden. So what were your general impressions of the Breakthrough project? So both you from your interview, but also I think you've had some involvement, Mike, as well.
I know. So in my general impression is essentially what is kind of summed up by Jamie Drew in his talk. He's like, it's the shape of things to come. And I really do believe that. And so the thing that I was impressed with about them in the interview and even their talks is that they're aiming to bring SETI into like the academic world, like really put it in the academic, like bring it out there. And also to introduce like more Silicon Valley dogma into it. It's to me really exciting what they're trying to do. And would they be able to do it? Time will tell. So they have like really large goals, but they also subdivided into really smaller ones. So my impression was that it's really exciting time to listen to them and even be involved in some way or the other.
Yeah. I also really enjoyed the interview and the conference from the Breakthrough Initiative guys. I asked a question about if the philanthropy will be the future of the fundamental science. I don't know how science is funded. So that, I think it's it, it's something that will be interesting to follow as well in the future, how things are going on with on that perspective.
And I guess that definitely is the case for lots of arts research, right? It's mainly funded through philanthropy.
Right, yeah.
And I guess science would be quite different if that was the way that it was entirely funded.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Breakthrough Listen project, which is just one of a number of initiatives that the Breakthrough Foundation sponsors, yeah, I think, as Hayden says, it's kind of placing SETI on a different level and doing really the first systematic surveys of stars, looking for signals, using some of the best telescopes in the world, and really having, you know, large amounts of observing time. So it's really a step up, and I'm very impressed by the people that they have involved in the project. They have a lot of good engineers, good scientists, and I think that's really important. Yeah, let's hope something positive comes out of it, like a SETI detection. That would be fantastic. But the other thing is that they're kind of in it for the long haul. So they're talking about a 10-year program. It's not that it's just going to be here for this year or next year. It's a 10-year program, and who knows, it may be extended beyond that.
Yep, Jamie Drew mentioned that putting it towards Meerkat and eventually the SK. And I think that shows vision to the future, is that we're using what we had. The aim is to do what we're doing in science now, is that use the current instruments, get the understand what we our parameter space is, try to understand how we go about doing it, and then put it towards the SK and really make it a real science for the SK. And I really was really impressed with that. I was really hearted because I did part of my PhD was also on SETI. And it was really heartening to see that this is actually being put forward as a real initiative. And yeah, so kudos to those guys.
Yeah, so we in previous meetings of the UK SETI Research Network, we had Andrew Simeon here. He wasn't able to make it to the last meeting, but I think, you know, Andrew's really the prime SETI researcher in the world, and he's the guy that's leading the Breakthrough Listen effort, which I think is really fantastic. And as you say, I think, you know, he recognises, but I think the community in general recognises that the SKA would be a fantastic SETI machine, and that a stepping stone to that is to look at the precursors like Meerkat, try and start using them, and I think they see that very much as a kind of stepping stone towards using the SKA.
Yeah. And so one other thing that kind of stood out is you think it's going to eventually become Argus, the old sky from Isaac Asimov.
I would like to think that at some point in the future that we could have a radio telescope that would have that fantastic field of view that Arthur C. Clarke described in his book Imperial Earth, the Argus telescope, where you would, you know, see the whole sky instantaneously. We need to kind of have a little bit more advances in computing and data processing and digitization and all those kind of things that are required, but that's coming, and it's only a matter of, you know, when we build that kind of telescope, yeah, not if. Yeah. And it could very well be, you know, what the next stage of the SK is after we've built phase one. That could be the type of technology that we need for phase two, and that would be, of course, be fantastic for astronomy, but I think it would be particularly interesting for SETI if SETI signals are quite rare. And then sky coverage can be actually quite important.
Mm-hmm. So we've also got an interview coming up with Stephen Baxter, who's a science fiction author, I believe.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a surprise to me, actually, that you were saying that the SETI doesn't just include scientists, that it also includes artists and sci-fi writers. So what kind of place do you feel they have in SETI and in the field? What do you think feel that they bring to the field?
So, as well as the UK meetings on SETI, there are sort of worldwide meetings. They are organised by the IAA. And again, they have this concept of, they have a session which is sort of conventional SETI astronomy engineering type presentations. But they also have something on, you know, the social aspects of SETI and the cultural and artistic aspects. And because it's one of those topics that appeals to everyone, not just astronomers, then, you know, there is an interest in, you know, how SETI impacts those different fields. And I've certainly noticed, you know, a lot of interaction between scientists, for example, and artists. And I can see artists getting enthusiastic about some of the ideas that scientists have, and maybe in a way that you don't see normally in most scientific topics. But SETI seems to be a kind of real attractor for artists and other people like that. And even at the meeting that we had last week, you could see we had one or two talks that were sort of at the edge of physics at some level, and you could be sceptical about those talks in some ways, but you noticed that they did actually have an impact on the people that were not physicists but artists, for example. They get sort of really motivated by some of these ideas that were bandied about, like faster than light travel, all those kind of things. So there's it's just a way to inspire people, many different disciplines, to new and different ways of looking at the common topic of interest being, you know, alien life out there.
Yeah, and I guess it kind of works both ways as well, in that the scientists can inspire the artists, but also, you know, as we were talking about the Arthur C. Clarke book, mm-hmm. and you're kind of going, oh, could we have that telescope? But you also, the scientists take inspiration from the writers and artists too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Arthur C. Clarke actually describes the LOFAR telescope, or the MWA telescopes that we're building now and we're just operating now. He described those 30 years ago, in fact 40 years ago. So, you know, the current authors of science fiction today, for example, we should be looking at those to get our ideas for tomorrow.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, because one of the questions I asked Stephen Baxter, and one thing I always wanted to ask, like, a sci-fi author, is, like, as you see it as from Arthur C. Clarke, as you go up, even go before Arthur C. Clarke, you're talking about H.G. Wells, even before that, Jules Verne, it's like you see science somehow parallelize it, like, okay, there's a time difference, but essentially parallelize it, and we got submarines and stuff like that not too far after Jules Verne. We went to the moon and we had flight, and Jules Verne spoke about that, from the Earth to the moon, and then H.G. Wells, and we keep going, and science seems to somehow always match science fiction expectations. And one thing I'm very interested in with Stephen Baxter, and we'll hear about it, is that, and Mike said about the current sci-fi authors, that does science fiction always have to keep its game up, because science always seems to be pushing sci-fi to level, and science and sci-fi seems to be leading science. Like, it's a communal relationship that I find as a kid growing up and getting into science from science fiction eventually. That it's a fascinating relationship it's just mind-boggling, especially what you see what the Breakthrough guys are trying to do as well, and then it's SK eventually, like, as mini version of Argus. It's getting really interesting.
Yeah. So well, now we've got the interview next up. So Jeff and Hayden interview Stephen Baxter about the crossover between science fact and science fiction.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Hayden Ramparat, and I'm here with
Jean-François Robitaille.
I'm both of us are postdocs here at the Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics, and for the last 2 days we were host to the UK SETI Research Network, and today we have our special guest, and we're very delighted to have Stephen Baxter with us, who's a famous sci-fi author. And so,
yeah, I guess the first question is, can we talk to us about your background and how you became or chose to be an accomplished science sci-fi author?
Well, it was a childhood dream, I suppose. You know, my first sensible ambition after wanting to be an astronaut and so on. Age 12 or 13, I was a big science fiction reader and got into science fiction in the first place through TV and the movies, Star Trek, you know. And I read a collection by Isaac Asimov. And in there, he described how he wrote each story when he was a teenager, working in his father's pharmacy shop, as I recall, and sending stories into magazines, you know, and gradually building up. And it was the first time, I'd never met a writer, you know, it was the first time I realized that writing was a career you could start, anybody could start from, you could start anywhere and get into it that way. So I was writing stories at an early age, 14 or 15. Okay. I had a teacher at school who wrote radio plays as a sideline. This is in Liverpool, by the way, so I grew up not far from here. I was speaking now. So he got me into professional habits by the age of about 16, finishing the stories properly and sending them to be sold. It took me a long time to build up any sales momentum. So I was following other careers. science fiction really got me to science and mathematics, and so that was my academic career. Ended up with a PhD in engineering, but I wasn't an academic. You know, the academic, with all respect, it wasn't for me. You know, the after the PhD part, you know, chasing endless contracts. Oh, and yeah. So I went into industry for a while. I worked as a teacher in a sixth form college. I think that's a typical writer's career. You kind of bounce around looking for, while all the time developing my writing career on the side. So finally gave up my other jobs, 1995, so late 30s by then. I published 6 or 7 novels, and they were. But really, basically starting from school age.
So you said that you've attended some of the UK SETI Research Network. You've been to all. Yeah. So what's the importance of sci-fi author? I guess if you say you're no longer academic or you don't identify as academic, what's the importance of attending these type of meetings? Is it for like ideas or to motivate others? Or?
Well, a bit of both, really, I'd say. Occasionally I get invited to attend meetings like this just as a sort of guest speaker. And that's what happened in the first place. 9 years ago now, 2008, Paul Davies, the physicist, is now the head of a committee to do with SETI called the Post-Detection Task Group. They look at societal implications of a detection of a radio signal from ETI or even direct contact with ETI. How would we handle it? What would the cultural implications be and so on? So I went along as a guest speaker to that. And I found that this group has been going for a long time, since the 60s, I think. But and there's usually been science fiction writers associated with it. You know, it's clearly within that domain. And so I volunteered to join at the meeting, that committee. So that got me into the SETI world. And for me, it's not quite so much generating ideas. It's just becoming informed with this stuff, mm-hmm. and also feeding back. You know, some of the more constructive speculation about the alien has been in the pages of science fiction novels, all the way back to H.G. Wells. So it's being part of the conversation, really, I think. So I write my books, but I've done some academic papers on SETI and SETI aspects as well, kind of fringe stuff, you might say. One, for example, was I was working on another project to do with an interstellar space probe using modern technology-ish, a fusion probe to Alpha Centauri. And one thing that struck me there was, what if the probe achieved contact? Suppose you have something like an Iron Age civilization that we can't see from here, can't signal to us, but there it is, and the planet, the probe's orbiting the planet, and it's clearly discernible from structures and so forth. What should the protocols be? Should it make contact? How should we equip it? What should it do? And I think actually it seems to me that we're going to have to decide that before we send such probes out. So that's academic, you see, but it's fringe speculation. And
I prepared a question that is, I think you already answered, but if you think you have other answers, you can go ahead.
Okay.
So yeah, so it's like we said before the recording, it's the first time I've been to a city conference before. And what was surprising is the amount of talks that are not necessarily discussing about the way we can detect life, intelligence life out there, or how we can understand the signal, but like the anticipation, like you just said, about what will happen if we are contact by someone else. So what do you think is the role of the sci-fi literature in this kind of anticipation? Context.
Yeah, I think it's adding to the imaginative scope of the speculation, in a way. But I think that's changed with time. Not my time with SETI, but since the beginning of the Enterprise in 1960. I'm not sure if the founders of SETI would admit this now, mm-hmm. but I think they expected to get result quite soon.
Okay.
Not immediately, but say within 10 years or 20 years. I think they really expected to find something. And of course they didn't. And you can rationalize that away. Now we're 50 years into SETI. 1960, 50 years from then on is 2010, isn't it? So we're in the sixth decade of SETI. Still we found nothing. So, so I think the speculation now is evolving somewhat, because on the other hand, we've now got the exoplanets, all that data on. It, I think one stat that was quoted at this meeting was that probably 1 in 5 stars has a planet in a habitable zone. So where Earth-like life with liquid water could conceivably arise. That's a heck of a lot of, hundreds of billions then of potential habitats for life. Why is that? Why? So it becomes more difficult to understand the silence. So I think the speculations about what's going on out there have changed because of this lack of evidence, you know, the absence of evidence at some point becomes evidence of absence. You can never prove. You could pick up a signal tomorrow, and which would throw all that away.
Yeah.
But in fact, now there are ingenious speculations about why we're not being seen. And I think I go along with Ian Crawford, an astronomer who was at the meeting today, and you'll have heard him say, to give him credit, that the most likely explanation seems to be either there's no intelligence at all, at least willing to signal for whatever reason, or the zoo hypothesis, which is where, like Star Trek, the Prime Directive, you stay back until you think the junior culture is ready for contact. Mm-hmm. They're hiding in some way. Because it's not just radio signals and so forth that you'd see noisy civilizations. Starships are a pretty energetic craft, you know. You'd see an antimatter starship from light years away, like the one in Avatar going to Alpha Centauri. You'd see it from light years away, this moving point. Probably if you had warp drive, massive, it would be like a neutron star being shoved along at somewhere close to the speed of light or beyond. These are pretty energetic events. It could be we're seeing those and not recognizing them. Mm. Gamma ray bursts might be starships, exhausts. But it does seem mysterious that as far out as we look, distant galaxies, you see no sign of modification on a large scale. So as far out as we look right across the observable universe, there's no sign of modification of that kind. It's pretty mysterious. So actually the zoo hypothesis, the idea that we're living in a kind of planetarium, well, it's filtered out, is plausible and it fits the facts. Or for some reason, nobody does this. Nobody makes a splash on a cosmically visible scale. But that seems strange as well. You only need one and you'd see it. The astronomers now are just another thing that came up in this meeting. Short-term radio bursts. The radio telescopes are discriminating enough now to pick up these things. You didn't know they existed 10 years ago. So those are like SETI events, like short-term bursts of radio energy. Now we're finding those, and yet we haven't found SETI. So the more the technology evolves and the more time goes on, the more the deeper the search gets, the more strange it becomes. And so I think in a way, science fiction can help by coming up with wacky scenarios to explain this stuff. Like the zoo hypothesis, really, I think was an SF idea before it became, I don't want to say academicized, but it became more formalized in academic papers. On the other hand, some of the more rigorous thinkers about this stuff follow a very science fiction-like logic. There's one paper here by Duncan Forgan, academic from Scotland, who was talking about how you would use transiting planets to signal to each other. Mm-hmm. So if somebody at Alpha Centauri sees the Earth transit the Sun, you could fire a laser beam from the middle of the shadow, or you could put a huge structure in orbit so you get peculiar observable transits of the star, that kind of thing. And if you're an SF writer, you take that as a beginning idea and then go on from there. And that's what Duncan Forgan did. He said, well, okay, you could have a whole network of these people, these civilizations speaking to each other. You can do statistics on the number of stars you could reach and so forth. I think they borrow a kind of science fiction logic as well. You take an idea and then push it as far as you can, which is H.G. Wells' basic technique. Pick some idea and then push it as far as you can and make a story out of it.
Yeah, that kind of led into, I kind of approached one of the questions I always wanted to ask a science fiction writer. Like, for instance, like back in from H.G. Wells' time, like sci-fi motivated a lot of science. Like, we have the cell phone because somebody essentially wanted to have the Star Trek communicator. And then you actually see translators, like, you know, similar people are developing, trying to have and even the tricorders.
Yeah.
And there's loads of it. Like, I got into to astronomy because SETI was a big thing. I also wanted to find out more about life out there.
Yeah.
Star Trek was a huge, huge influence. Reading the books of Isaac Asimov and yourself motivated like a lot of generations. But now that we're reaching science is becoming, it's reaching those science fiction. It's getting close to those. Like we see Starshot, Starshot is aiming to do that same thing what you talked about and put sending a probe to Alpha Centauri. So now that we're getting so close, that science is really like, if you draw a curve, that they're kind of merging. What does that mean for sci-fi for the future? Does it have to like really up its game and really go forward or take the current ideas? And I think you just mentioned it as well, and just jump forward and just keep pushing science.
Oh well, I think basically you keep pushing science. Yeah, I think that it's always felt like that.
Mm.
That reality is catching up with the science fiction. So H.G. Wells' mechanized warfare. It took till it was the Second World War was more like his pre First World War vision.
Yeah.
of populations in flight from a mechanized foe. Then the lunar landing, I do remember 1969, there was a lot of discussion then about, is that the end of science fiction then? Well, it was the end of a certain kind of science fiction. You know, there's always further horizons. And besides, the cultural assumptions change a lot. So if you're writing a book now about the colonization of the solar system over the next two centuries, it will probably look and feel quite differently from how it would have looked in 1940 or 50, because we're much more aware now of conservation issues and climate problems and resource depletion and so forth. And, you know, you can look out to a kind of an exponential expansion beyond the Earth, and pretty soon you've used up all the asteroids, all the moons and so forth, and you're facing the same kind of dilemmas as we face now. So you can have you could look at the same time scale, but with different assumptions. So the story always moves on. And I think for each generation, to be honest, it seems to me what they respond to, it subtly changes as well. Science fiction is really all about the fears and dreams of the present in which it's written. And you have, depending on what you can write anything, you know, but I go for hard SF, which is as plausible as possible within the laws of physics. Even say you're selecting like from a tree of possible futures, but the possible future you'd select is always conditioned in a way by what you're writing from now. For instance, in my Zeely novels, I've been working on those. My first published story was in the Zeely universe, 30 years ago now. And I keep on going back to this because I think it's pretty good discipline for me personally. That was my original influences, you know, all coming together. So going back to that is like going back to the well again. But about 20 years ago, I was thinking about the nearish future. So the Zeely's interstellar future. What's the nearest future, the next few thousand years? And I came up with this vision of the Earth, as I would like to see it, by the year 4000, as it from space it looks natural again. You know, maybe there's a couple of cities dotted around, but it looks natural. The forests are back, the animals are back. But it's a very high-tech civilization living very discreetly off the natural energy flows of the planet, which must be possible with efficient enough technology. As little damage as possible is done to the place. You disturb the energy flows and mass flows as little as possible, restore some of the lost animals and so forth. Low-ish population, say a billion, you know, it still seems plenty of people to me. That's not a bad vision, but the question is how you get there from here. Yeah. Which is quite different from so that's a 1990s vision. The 1940s vision of the Earth was more like, is it Coruscant in Star Wars, where it's entirely plated over the huge city? That seemed like utopia back then, but now we know that's, you know, nightmare.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Imagining not a dystopian universe, but then something that is environmental.
Yes.
So that's very good. So coming back to this city research, your talk today was, if I do not mistake, mostly about the what would be the intentions of an alien coming on Earth, and I don't know if you want to discuss about it's your last book.
My most recent book. It's called The Massacre of Mankind, and it's a sequel to H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds. So, you know, at the end of the novel, the Martians die off because he weren't prepared for the bacteria in Earth's atmosphere. But in my novel, they come back again 15 years later and have another try, more prepared and more systematic. But they have to come. It's a climate collapse on Mars. This is the old Lowell picture of Mars and a cooling sun. We now know the sun's heating up, so we'll have to move for other reasons in the future. But they come to the Earth. It's warmer, you know. They've been struggling with this situation for a million years, according to Wells. And so back they come. But my talk today for the SETI group was really about how the public react to fictional aliens, which is the nearest thing we've had to contact with the alien after all. And in particular, Wells's and my Martians, because when you do a book launch, I did some bits on the radio and the telly, but I went around bookshops around the country, London up to Edinburgh, giving talks about the book and so on, and reading bits, and I found people were very interested in the Martians and the development of the Martians in my book, because everyone thinks they know about Wells's Martians, you know, the fighting machines and everything, the way you think you know Superman and Doctor Who and Mr. Spock and a small handful of other aliens that have survived in popular culture. So I'm quite interested in that. And I think with the Martians in particular, because they have this logical story, they're not conquistadors or imperialists in that way. They are migrants. They have to come again. So you can sympathize with that. And they do, on their own level, the moral, they help each other when they fall in battle, that kind of thing. Well, they've got this fatal flaw which we share. And anybody lower than them in the pecking order, they've got no sympathy for. They're using us as livestock. Well, that's their ambition anyway. Just as we do, you know, like the chimps and so on. So, however, and it's fiction, you know, no Martian actually blew up my grandfather in the year 1900. I'd probably hold a grudge. You can separate out that reality in a sense, and you can understand why they're here. So even though you may not welcome them, and you'd resist them and so forth, you can have a certain compassion for them because they're driven to this desperate extent. And in Wells's novel, going to the other end of the story, the beginning of the story, the cylinders land in southern England and they smash everything up, just the landing, set fire to the heath, you know. But the first reaction of the local people is to try and help the beings inside. They know nothing about them, but they try and help. They think the cylinder might be stuck. Closed. They're going to burn up in there. So they try to save them, and then they try to signal to them in a way with white flags, you know. So the impulse is to signal and communicate and help. And so I was quite struck by the public response to all this as I was discussing it. You know, it seems to me that we do have the capability, at least in theory, of comprehending these alien beasts and seeing beyond their immediate actions, their destructiveness and so on. See, why are they actually here? Why we should be equipped with mental muscles to recognize the alien and sympathize with it is another question. It could be that it's just our habit of projecting personality onto everything, onto gadgets and pets, and so on. Just as in the past, you know, early physical theories were about how, you know, a falling ball wants to move down towards the earth and so forth. Or animism, these even earlier theories of the universe. It's better than no theory at all. So it could be a kind of flaw in a way, or it could be a strength, because we did, one of my pet theories about the alien is that we evolved among aliens, other kinds of hominid running around the planet. I don't know what the current estimate is, but many kinds as we evolved, all of which we pushed away in the end and outcompeted. But, you know, you go over the hill and you'd find another kind of people over there. Not just strangers, but a different kind of human with different ways of thinking and so forth. So maybe we're equipped to expect a landscape like that. And now it's depopulated, really, except for the chimps, which is quite remote from us, really. So maybe that's why we dream of aliens and used to dream of angels and demons and ghosts and so forth. It's because there's a gap in our perceptual universe.
So coming to H.G. Wells' novel, So he wrote it when the aliens came, you said that, well, and the humans show compassion to the Martians and stuff. If he had written not now, say the first contact now happened, do you think the response would be the same given the current climate of the world right now?
That's a very difficult question. A book like Wells's has survived because it's got many levels of meaning, and his initial inspiration was about colonialism. There was a horrific story of the British wiping out the Tasmanians off the coast of Australia completely in a few generations. Terrible. And you know, history is full of these awful colonial crimes. And that one specifically inspired Wells to write something about, well, if someone fell down from the sky and did the same to us, we could hardly complain. However, it has got these other levels of meaning. Yeah. So there's the mechanized warfare that worked out in through the 20th century. And now the climate migrant thing is, you know, that's clearly going to be a big aspect. It's a big aspect of the present. It's going to be a big aspect of the future. And that's what we can maybe take away from now. So I suspect if Wells was writing it now, then possibly, he would play up that side. He would say, look how we're turning away these boat people. You know, it would serve us right if we tried to move to Mars and they turned us away. See, I think you'd have the same kind of extrapolation.
Mm. So coming back to the meeting that we had this week.
Yeah.
So as someone who's written for like a couple of decades now, especially about traveling and finding aliens and essentially in quote unquote SETI type things.
Yeah.
And seeing it's happening now and being part of a community that's actually actively involved in it, and then we've seen breakthroughs actually aiming to jumpstart that. What's your thoughts on the general, how it's going about now?
The SETI enterprise. Yeah. It's clearly something that's always evolved as negative results have come in. Kind of as I said before, did you know that there was a prize given towards the end of the 19th century for detecting evidence of life beyond Earth? Mm-hmm. And they disqualified Mars. They thought that as soon as they had a radio receiver big enough, that then, you know, they would hear radio signals from Mars. They just assumed. So you couldn't win the prize by detecting life on Mars. So that one fell over, you know, and we found that the solar system was more barren than we might have hoped. In terms of our kind of life, at least. And as I said, the early SETI experimenters, I'm pretty sure, thought they'd find something soon. So it's evolving. It's looking for other kinds of SETI evidence, fitting these new hypotheses. I think one interesting one is looking for evidence of life in the past. Suppose intelligent life is evanescent. You know, you collapse because you run out of resources and you may survive, but you're no longer signaling to the stars. Seems quite possible. So there's talk now looking for evidence of, well, artifacts left on the moon, let's say, a probe left by an alien. Or even more convincing in a way is just exotic products in interstellar dust, exhaust from starships, basically. Find some titanium in moon dust or something like that. It's something that couldn't have got there by any natural process. That's something that could have been drifting around the galaxy for a billion years, and yet it would still show up now, evidence of something in the past. Quite convincing and compelling threads to follow. However, I do have private theories, possibly most of the academics do as well, but they could never admit it because they'd never get funded again. That maybe we're just missing it, you know. Maybe quasars or industrial catastrophes at the beginning of the beginning of the universe. Maybe there was a gigantic explosion in the middle of the galaxy. It was 100,000 years ago, something like that. There was a big ring of molecular dust being wafting out from the black hole. Maybe that was evidence of a war. It is in one of my novels, you know. So you have to assume that it's natural causes. And you have to prove extraordinary claims and need extraordinary evidence. So you start with that and you work down a scale of these things before you get to the artifact hypothesis. But it could be that some of what we're seeing out there is actually artifacts. Right. Maybe something quite subtle as well. Suppose there was a colonization wave that's sweeping across the galaxy, consuming something like, I don't know, nitrogen. You look one way, you see a nitrogen depletion, you look the other way. There's no nitrogen depletion on certain exoplanets, let's say. How can that be? Well, because the colonizing wave got that far and it's moving on or it's stopped. So there may be subtle things like that. We come up with theories about formation of planets in different parts of the galaxy, wouldn't we, and so forth. But it may be that kind of thing as well, depletions, strange depletions, is evidence of resource consumption in the past. So it could be, frankly, that the evidence is right under our noses, we're just not seeing it in the right way.
Yeah. Mm. New point of view are always welcome.
Well, I have one more question, if you have any more.
No, that's fine.
So, okay, well, one last question from my point of view. As someone who's like dabbling slightly in sci-fi on evenings, I would think of these things because, I mean, reading lots of sci-fi and then actually doing science, like I'm involved in SETI and a lot of other things like SK and stuff.
Yeah.
I tend to think about some of these things as well. Like, but for a general listener, like who's interested in like, What advice you would give to, like, if they want to, like, get involved in writing sci-fi, or at least putting down their own story, even just on paper, for themselves to read?
Oh, well, basic advice is just to do it. Just write. I think in some ways it's more difficult now because there are distractions, online media stuff. Mm. And if you pitch a novel to a publisher, they will say, what kind of online presence have you got? Because they can use that to advertise. So there's a real danger that you get distracted by your Twitter feed as opposed to the novel you're supposed to be writing. It's a solitary, patient thing where you have to manage your own time. You'll know about it. It's like writing papers or a thesis even. You've got to do it yourself in the end. You get feedback from other people, but you've got to manage your own time in long chunks. And that's not going to change. So personally, I would avoid workshops and courses. Because that's not what writing is, you know. You don't sit there working with other people. Well, I know you do on some collaborative projects, screenwriting and so on. But if you're writing a novel, it's just you alone. I'd recommend doing a correspondence course if you want to do something to develop the writing, where you can get these things now. And I did one 30 years ago. Where on short story writing, you get like a monthly exercise, which maybe writing fragments in a certain style, or maybe writing a short story on a certain topic. But you're actually writing, you're doing the job in the way that you'll have to do in the future. Then you get feedback from that's my basic advice, is just to write. And, you know, you will be expected to sort of promote yourself through Twitter feeds and stuff, but that's not the job. You've got to just write and do it. In my day, there was the same kind of questions would be asked. You know, well, what have you done? What interesting things have you done in the past that we can now promote? And the most interesting thing I ever came up with was applying to be an astronaut. And I did, actually. Yeah, when this is about 25 years ago, the Mir was hosting guest cosmonauts, and they wanted one from Britain, and there was an open application. Anyone could apply. So I did, and I got through several stages. I was the right age, I had a science background. You'd have to do some basic science up there. But I didn't have a foreign language. Any foreign language would have done. But I got through several stages, you know, and I wish I'd lied about it. You know, maybe got to Star City. I'm not sure if I would have been brave enough to do the physical stuff in the end, but at least that's an anecdote you can put on a press release.
Yeah. I think that's it. Thanks a lot, Stephen, for your time. It was enjoyable, and
it's
a great pleasure to have a chat with you.
Good, thank you.
I think that's it.
Thanks for that, Hayden and Jeff. So, for all of you three, what else stood out for you about the conference?
Well, one thing was one guy spoke of, I think it was Ian Crawford, and I think it's still in my head is that searching for artifacts, it's like on the moon. And in our near solar systems, like for instance, the idea is that over the last, since the existence of the Earth and the Moon, that we've traveled around our galaxy a couple times. I don't know how many times, but you could work it out. And that during that time, that if there was civilization popping in and out and in existence, and because they were so far apart, they probably wouldn't speak to each other, that essentially that our solar system, which essentially pick up artifacts from these civilizations, and that may be within our system, it could possibly be there. And one idea is to use machine learning to get images of our presence there in the solar system. Use that to train machines, computers, because while we are going out into our solar system, we have images of our solar system. And the idea is to use our presence in the solar system right now, use machines to essentially train to look at these images and see if we could pick up any other artificial presence that's not due to us. I found that kind of interesting because it's an idea I had for a while. So I did find that, for me, was pretty interesting.
There's many talks as well that I really enjoyed. There was one as well from Matt Colburn. It was about the consciousness and SETI. So I really like this one because I think what science is doing in terms of research on the brain is evolving as well, and at the same time people should also ask themselves the question how we should define intelligence itself, and how consciousness is involved in intelligence itself. And he also brought the idea that maybe in the famous Drake equation we should add this term of consciousness, not only what is the chance that we find an intelligent extraterrestrial life somewhere, but also are they self-conscious. So I found it really interesting, and also our way to analyze data change with time. And there was also another talk about this again famous Drake equation and how we can maybe do a Bayesian analysis of the Drake equation, and I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, no, I agree. Those were really good talks. And going back to Hayden's point about the artifacts, I found it interesting in Ian Crawford's talk. He mentioned that the moon sort of preserves everything on its surface roughly for about 100 million years. Mm. So that's like the cratering sort of lifetime of the moon. After 100 million years, you get hit by something, so mm-hmm. whatever's there gets obliterated or at least broken up. But you know, that's a long period in which to go to the moon and look to see what's kind of fallen down there, and mm-hmm. if there's anything interesting like alloys from, you know, passing spacecraft that come off the engines, etc. And I think he mentioned that you need to be able to process something like a square kilometer of the lunar surface mm-hmm. in order to be able to pick, you know, some of these mm-hmm. you know, these are alloys that would only arise because you have an intelligence that's produced them. Although I'm not sure people have really thought about whether some of these things can actually be also produced by natural processes mm-hmm. or not. So clearly a lot of interesting things to do there. Yeah.
Yeah, no, that is a possibility. It's never even crossed my mind. So that's really interesting to hear about that being a different approach, about finding evidence for life.
I suppose one thing that I'm keen on personally is, you know, whether there are also artifacts in our astronomical data. You know, our instruments, you know, they improve all and all the time. But we tend to, as astronomers, as I mentioned before, we tend to kind of just look up, and we're only interested in measuring, you know, that thing that we're kind of expecting to see. And often we throw away the things that we don't want. So, you know, if we get interference in our radio data, then we very casually just throw that all away. And, you know, there could be some SETI signals in there. But also, not just in the radio, also across the electromagnetic spectrum, we should be on the lookout for things that don't match up with our expectations. They may be new astrophysical phenomena, but they might actually also be signatures of, you know, advanced civilizations.
And I guess that comes back to a wider point as well in astronomy about, you know, a lot of data is thrown away. And I know there was someone here, for example, who was working on planetary nebula and managed to get a data set that someone else was just basically just chucking in the bin because it was of no use to them. But actually, she managed to find new planetary nebula in it.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. but there's lots of cases where that happens in science, right? Because it doesn't meet your science case, so you don't use it. And finding the person who would use it takes time that you don't necessarily have. So especially as surveys get bigger and have more data, you need to think about strategies to avoid that.
This is slightly off topic, but it was an idea I had while doing my PhD. So I had the same struggle. I was trying to get data for a particular object, and I had to keep going to people and asking them, begging them for, hey, do you have this data? Some of them have it, some of them don't remember where to put it. I kind of think of a really cool idea would be if we have like a social network, like with, like essentially a science version of Facebook, where people could post and say, right, I'm working on this, does anybody have data? And then you could just post your data on it, and then when people working on something, it's like, well, I've written this paper on such and such, I have this data on such and such, is anybody interested in it? I mean, you could keep it on your hard drive and then like have that sort of interaction. So, and someone like, for instance, the person who did planetary nebula, they could like, well, I'm interested in this region, do you have anything on it, just this region? And I'm like, oh yeah, here's all this data. And then you could go ahead and start analyzing it. It was a frustrating time to try and beg people to get data when I was thinking about, so yeah.
I think something like that would be really helpful. If you've got the time, I think everyone would appreciate that.
Yes. So one other thing that was interesting is from Mike's talk, actually, that the speed of light is, we always think it's so fast. I mean, as a kid himself, I thought it was always very fast. But then when you look at the scale of the galaxy, it's essentially so slow. It's really slow because civilization, lifetimes of civilization could pop in existence and pop out. Between the crosstalk and Mike had this really nice animation, we had the galaxy. You could imagine a galaxy and then like on one arm, a civilization popped in and it popped out. And then on the other side, another civilization popped out. But then if you try to trace the speed of light between them, they will pop in and pop out of existence before the signals between each one of them meet each other. And it was just mind-blowing to actually put it in perspective after so many years doing science, to actually have that makes you realize how slow speed of light is, and we're actually fighting against the speed of light. So yeah, that was very interesting for me. And now that leads us to the question of the week, this week's question, and here Francesca and Matt would ask an astronomer.
Hi, I'm Francesca, and I'm here with Matt, and this is this month's Ask an Astronomer. So the first question is from Henning Vester Jorgensen from Denmark, and he says, I am always a little confused about the mass momentum thing regarding photons. I'm thinking of the observations confirming Einstein's theory. Did Newtonian theory predict the light would not bend at all? I mean, the photons have a mass equivalent, right? Or did Newtonian theory just predict it bent less than the relativistic prediction?
So that's a very good question. So the mass that you described is not the mass in our usual understanding, such as I have a mass of X kilograms, the Earth has mass of Y kilograms, and so on. This sort of mass is called the rest mass, and any object with a non-zero rest mass cannot travel at the speed of light, as that would require an infinite amount of energy. The mass of photon we talk about in the framework of special relativity is a relativistic mass, and it It is indeed proportional to the photon's momentum. To answer to your question, we, however, don't have to use any special relativity or general relativity and can only limit ourselves to simple reasoning used in Newtonian dynamics. So the most important answer is that Newtonian dynamics did indeed predict that the light would bend in the presence of mass. Newton himself posted this question in the last volume of his book Optics. It reads, "Do not bodies act upon light at the distance and by their action bend its rays? And it's not this action strongest at the least distance?" So from this question, we can already see that Newton was quite seriously considering this problem. At that time, we are fairly confident that Newton treated light rays as entities composed of very small objects emitted by stars and anything that really shines. Objects that we may today call photons, so he wasn't really bothered about what we call today the wave-particle duality. At that time, they were only considering light rays as packets of some small objects. He knew that the acceleration of the body in the presence of gravitational force does not depend on the mass of the accelerated body. Well, we all remember the feather and hammer experiment performed on the surface of the moon by the crew of Apollo 15 mission. That was known in the time of Newton as well, that whatever you drop in the presence of gravitational field, its acceleration will not depend on its mass. So, you know, there was really nothing stopping massless objects from accelerating as well. If acceleration does not depend on the mass of the objects, why wouldn't massless objects accelerate? Newton, however, never really answered this question himself in any of his publications. So really, he just posted this question, but we don't have any evidence that he really, really tried to answer it. Work published by Johann Soldner at the beginning of the 19th century is one of the first, if not the first, works that tried to calculate the full solution to this problem. So as you can see, the question and the solution of whether the path of light can be bent by massive objects predates Einstein's general theory of relativity and its concepts of space-time by more than 100 years. The amount by which the light would bend if Newtonian theory of gravity was correct on large scales was found to be half of the value predicted by Einstein's GTR. It is not quite common to hear that the 1919 expedition led Sir Arthur Eddington to observe and record any changes in positions of stars during solar eclipse was able to confirm the validity of GTR because they have detected that the trajectory of light was bent by the mass of sun. In reality, what Eddington was looking for was whether the angle of deflection was consistent with Newton's or Einstein's theories of gravity. He was able to confirm, not without many problems and facing massive oppositions from the supporters of the Newtonian gravity, that the angle that the rays of light went bent at was consistent with Einstein's, not Newtonian gravity. And that provided, as we know, pretty much a first successful confirmation of the new theory of gravity. For those of our listeners interested in a more rigorous derivation, the full solution to this problem can be found in a short 2009 paper, Newtonian Gravitational Deflection of Light Revisited.
Thank you. Thanks. Moving on to the next question. This is from Ben Dyer. And they ask, "I've read the speed of light is different in different media, air, water, etc., and only has the speed c in a complete vacuum. First of all, is this the case, and what are some good examples? Secondly, does the speed of light therefore slow in diffuse gas clouds in the galaxy / universe, and does this effect build to a point where it affects the age of the light reaching us in any meaningful way? Thirdly, would this slowing, if it happens, affect redshift?"
So when we really talk about light waves, or indeed any waves, we usually talk about two velocities, group velocity and phase velocity. Group velocity is the velocity at which the general envelope of the multi-frequency wave moves through the space. And in most real-life scenarios, it can be considered as the velocity at which the information is carried through the medium. Phase velocity, on the other hand, is the velocity of the individual waves inside the envelope. So let's start with the phase velocity, because it's mostly common to what we see on Earth. It can be defined as the speed of light divided by the refractive index. So refractive index is an intrinsic property of the material which describes how fast light travels in a given medium and how much light bends when it enters or exits this medium. In dielectric materials, the refractive index is a function of frequency, and generally it increases as the frequency of light increases. So we can see that for light at different frequencies, the refractive index will change, and therefore the speed already at which the different frequency components of light, of visible light, they will travel at different velocities. And I think that the best and arguably one of the most beautiful examples of this to demonstrate the dependence of phase velocity on the frequency is simply prism. What do we see as white light? Is in fact composed of a whole spectrum of different colors, between blue and purple at the highest frequency part of the spectrum, and red at the lowest one. The refractive index, as I said before, will therefore be different for different components, even if only slightly, and the rate of white light will be split at each of the components, would take a slightly different path due to different refractive indices, with the blue-purple colors that have the lowest velocity bend more than the orange and red traveling a bit faster. If we consider a monochromatic light wave, it is light at a single wavelength. The refraction of light itself is already a manifestation of the fact that the light travels at different speeds in different media. The situation changes when we start talking not about dielectric materials, but deionized interstellar medium, something that we astronomers are interested in. In this case, we do consider group velocity, really, because this, as I said, is information that is arriving to us. This is the information that we're recording. The group velocity in an ionized dispersive medium will always be lower than the speed of light for waves with a frequency greater than the plasma frequency, which for the interstellar medium is close to 1.4 kHz. Theoretically, it is impossible to travel for waves that have frequency lower than the plasma frequency, so whatever we really can observe has to be higher than the plasma frequency and will be traveling at the speed lower than the speed of light. And what is more important is again that the speed of light depends again on the frequency, this time due to presence of free floating electrons in the ionized medium. It means that unless you are in the perfect vacuum, and by vacuum I mean absolutely nothing, and even the vacuum that we describe in space does not feel this requirement, as I will explain later, the speed of light will be different for different frequencies. The electromagnetic waves at higher frequencies will be slowed down less than those at lower frequencies. The energy of the photon is proportional to its frequency, so you can imagine that photons at higher frequencies will have more energy to push through matter that is trying to stop them. Similarly to when you run through the crowded shopping center, it is easier to push people out of your way than when you walk slowly. And please don't do this, and I do not advise running through the crowded shopping center, and do not take any responsibility for any possible injuries or problems with law that it may cause. This property of light can cause some interesting effects in some of the data we record. I personally work with pulsars and fast radio bursts, and one of the ways we can measure the distance to these objects is through the so-called dispersion measure. As the name can suggest, it has a lot in common with the dispersion in water droplets or in prism that I have talked about. Even though we talk about vacuum in space, this vacuum doesn't really mean a perfect nothingness or emptiness. We can still find atoms and subatomic particles floating in space. There are present at very small densities, and on average you can find about one atom of hydrogen per cubic centimeter. But the density in different regions of our galaxy can differ by a few orders of magnitude, depending on whether you are in the less dense outskirts of the galaxy, or more crowded spiral arms, or the densest galactic center. But even at such small densities, the light can interact with the matter between stars and galaxies and produce visible effects, the dispersion measure being one of them. When we record the signal coming from a pulsar using a radio telescope, such as our very own Lovell telescope at the Jodrell Bank Observatory, we do it over a finite bandwidth, usually a multiple of megahertz. What we see is that every pulse from the pulsar arrives first at the highest frequency part of the spectrum, with lower frequencies arriving later. This effect has a quadratic dependence on frequency, so you can expect that a signal emitted at 1 GHz will have a dispersion delay 4 times greater than the signal travelling at 2 GHz. The difference in arrival times between the highest and lowest frequencies in our measured band depends on the center frequency at which you observe, the bandwidth you use, and the amount of stuff between you and the object you observe, and it can be anywhere between a fraction of a second up to tens of seconds for lowest observing frequencies and largest distances. The effect of dispersion broadens the recorded pulse and reduces signal-to-noise ratio, and therefore has to be removed in a rather computationally expensive process using complicated, carefully tuned computer algorithms. But pulsar dispersion is not all bad. By measuring the dispersion of the pulsar, we effectively measure the amount of matter the radiation interacts with as it travels towards our telescope. If we have an independent estimate of the distance to the pulsar obtained through, for example, parallax measurements, we can then measure the electron density along the line of sight, which can tell us more about the composition of our Milky Way. The situation gets even more complicated when we move further away from our galaxy, so far that we have to take cosmological effects such as the expansion of the universe that you have mentioned in your question into account. That makes everything more complicated, but to be honest, as pulsar astronomers, we did not have to be concerned about this problem, as the vast majority of the objects we observe in the radio part of the spectrum are within our Milky Way, where we don't have to worry too much about the expansion of the universe. It all changed, however, in 2007 with the discovery of the first fast radio bursts. We now believe that these are events that take place at cosmological distances, with redshifts usually greater than a half, where the effects of the expansion of the universe have to be taken into account because they are important for our equations. As the universe expands, the wavelength of the signal emitted from the object increases and its frequency decreases. That makes the frequency of the recorded signal a function of distance to the object, and we have to be really careful when using it with our usual dispersion measure calculations. We have to include not only the amount of matter into the galactic medium that we know much less about than about interstellar medium, but also the correct cosmological models that depend on the curvature and the composition of the universe if we really want to get a correct distance to these objects. So things get much more complicated the further you go away from us.
And finally this week, Tom Perry asks, how does the concept of year figure into light year measurements? A year seems so Earth-centric that it's hard for me to understand how light is measured by a year.
So a question like that comes up fairly often in one form or another, mainly because a year is rather confusingly used for measuring distance. So first, let's quote a definition by International Astronomical Union, which says that a light year is equal to the distance traveled by light in one Julian year in a vacuum, as measured here on Earth. And by Julian year, we mean 365 and a quarter of a day. So in a sense, yes, it's a fairly Earth-centric as we use our Earth year. It is, however, very convenient to use. We use it because it makes expressing vast distances in the universe much easier. It is easier to say that Proxima Centauri is 4.25 light years away from the Earth, rather than saying it's at the distance of more than 4 × 10^16 meters, or 40 trillion kilometers. That would make writing papers and books pretty horrible. If needed, it can be still expressed in meters and using equations that rely on SI unit, but it's much more practical to use it when comparing the distances to an object. It can also help us talk about the travel times between objects in the universe. If I say that TRAPPIST-1 is at the distance of around 40 light years from the Earth, you know that it would take us 40 years to get there when traveling at the speed of light, which is impossible. 80 years at half the speed of light, etc. But if I told you the distance was 38 × 10^13 kilometers, I personally would have no idea whether that's very far or very, very far. So again, in this sense, light year is just a very convenient way of putting very large distances into easily manageable numbers. And it's very useful because it really has a very simple definition. A light year is also not the only Earth-centric unit of measure of distance. The other one, in my opinion, is the astronomical unit, which is more or less defined as a mean distance between the Sun and the Earth. When our solar system is concerned, defining one AU as close to 150 million kilometers and using it for measuring distances between objects in our system makes sense. One light year is equal to little bit more than 63,241 AU, so at larger distances it simply makes sense to talk about light years rather than millions of astronomical units. And as you have said, these are very Earth-centering and not universal, so if we were to meet a civilization living on a planet much closer to the host star with a much shorter period, their definition of light year and astronomical unit, if they actually had any, would be totally different. But let's be honest, in this case, even our choice of meter would be pretty much arbitrary.
Thanks for that, Francesca and Matt. Now on to the feedback.
So we don't actually have any feedback this episode. Our pigeonhole was sadly empty, but we did get some nice photos of the Lovell telescope from David Gelsthorpe and Gary Stiles on Twitter. And if you do want to get in touch, you can do so via the website at www.jodcast.net.
On Twitter at twitter.com/jodcast.
Also via Facebook at facebook.com/jodcast.
And for the YouTubers out there, at youtube.com/jodcast.
At Flickr at flickr.com/groups/jodcast.
And don't forget that you can send this post. The address is on the website.
Thanks to Jamie Drew, Danny Price and Stephen Baxter for the interviews. The editors were Alex Clark, Naomi Asabra-Frimpong, Thomas Scragg and Ian Evans. The producers were Jake Morgan and Benjamin Shaw. Until next time.
Jod on.